Today, do the bears have it? Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 17th of November 2018, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And it's been a roller coaster ride on all fronts this week, with more market gyrations, larger predicted falls in home prices locally, and the first unnatural act from the government to try and sustain the finance sector ahead of next year's election. And we can expect more ahead. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. Here is the link, and it's in the comments below. We start with the markets this week. The Dow closed lower for the week, despite a rally on Friday that came despite the White House reportedly walking back President Donald Trump's upbeat comments on trade. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.49% to 25,413 at the end of the week, and the S&P 500 rose 0.22% to 2,736, but the Nasdaq Composite fell 0.15%. After the falls earlier in the week, Wall Street went into rally mode on Friday, after Trump said that he was hopeful that the US and China will reach a consensus on a trade deal. But later, the White House proceeded to introduce a more somber narrative on trade in the wake of Trump's comments, telling CNBC that the deal was not coming soon. Still, the broader averages held their gains, but that did little to avert a weekly loss following a rout in tech. The fear index, the VIX, eased a little on Friday, down 9.21% to 18.14, but it is still elevated, signalling uncertainty ahead. In tech, Facebook fell 3% amid the fallout from a New York Times article detailing how the company conspired to cover up warnings that Russia had used the social media platform to disrupt the US election in 2016. Apple moved higher after recent falls, up 1.11% to $193.53, while Alphabet fell 0.26% to $1,068. Intel was up 1.5% to $48.53. Financials were mixed, with the S&P Financials Index up 0.06% on Friday to $443.45, but Goldman Sachs Group was down 0.8% to $202.12. Sentiment on stocks were also lifted by easing concerns about steeper US rate increases after the Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Richard Colarida indicated that the US Central Bank may stop at the neutral rate rather than continuing to hike beyond the neutral rate, which might be interpreted as, in effect, a rate cut. The three-month bond rate slid 0.67% to 2.35, and the 10-year was down 1.71% on Friday to 3.065. Clarida also did not expect a big increase in inflation this year. But though with that in mind, central bankers are still confident enough in the domestic economy to proceed with the December rate hike, but there is a good chance that it will be accompanied by a less hawkish outlook. Energy added steel to the rally on Friday as oil prices settled flat but slumped 6% on the week on concerns about a global glut in supplies. The WTI futures was up 0.66% to 56.83. Oil bears are back to taunting Saudi Arabia by pressurizing the market again just 2 days after giving a reprieve to the record sell-off in crude on fears that the oil-rich kingdom and the OPEC cartel it leads could cut supplies substantially at a December 6-7 meeting. Friday's rebound didn't help crude's weekly loss of 6%, making it the sixth straight week in the red. Prices initially rose on an analysis from tanker tracking firm Clipper Data that showed Saudi Arabia was already loading fewer barrels on ships bound for the United States this month, continuing a trend that began in September. By sending fewer barrels to the US, the Saudis hope to starve the US crude stockpiles, which have swelled by nearly 50 million barrels the past 8 weeks. It's a strategy that the kingdom used last year while working alongside OPEC members, Russia, and other producers to rescue oil prices from lows under $50 a barrel. But after the mounting highs in New York trade, prices turned volatile before returning to positive territory just before the close. Adding pressure to the market was weekly US oil rig data showing drilling activity at its highest in over 3 years after an additional 2 rigs were added this week. In an extreme turn of events, the fire from Bitcoin's cash hard-fought war has spread wildly across the entire crypto market, burning through virtually every cryptocurrency and leaving many investors burnt too. Bitcoin had more than $6 billion stripped from its market value as it fell beyond the support of its long-standing safety net of $5,800. But gold was higher at 1.9% to $1,222 on Friday, with some suggesting that the US bull run might be ending as economic outperformance, rising interest rates, equity market pressure, and trade policy all look suspect. And a switch to metals might make sense. But it's more likely it's to do with the risks around Brexit, as Theresa May could be fighting for her political survival, but the Brexit crisis that she's in has thrown gold bulls a lifeline. Initially resigned to losing the market's 1,200 support level at the week's start, fans of the yellow metal not only got to stay in their comfort zone, but also saw their best weekly gain in 5, as hedgers rushed to the relative safety of bullion after the pounding taken by sterling from Britain's EU exit woes. Tory MPs may have enough votes, 48 are needed, for a letter of no confidence that could force a vote in Parliament. But if the rebels within her ranks do really have the votes to force a no confidence motion, UK politics will be thrown into an even greater existential crisis. But changing leader would not necessarily make much difference. In fact, UK Prime Minister May on Friday reshuffled her ministerial team and took personal charge of the divorce talks with the European Union. The moves came at the end of an extraordinary week in which 7 members of her government resigned and a push to force her from power gained momentum. The pound gained 0.4% against the US dollar on Friday, rebounding a bit from Thursday's plunge, but sterling still suffered a loss for the week, and the volatility soared to a 2-year high. The British pound was up 0.48% on Friday to 1.2835, whilst the euro US dollar rose 0.76% to 1.1414. The US dollar index fell 0.51% to 96.43. And Deutsche Bank, one of our bellwethers, was down 0.06% to 8.59, not helped by recent Eurozone bank stress test results. All 3 of the commodity currencies traded higher on Friday, with the Australian hitting a 2-month high and the New Zealand dollar hitting a 4-month high. Both ripped higher on the hope that President Trump will forego another round of tariffs on China. Ever since the midterm elections, his tone towards China has been softening. The Aussie ended up 0.76% to 73.32, helped by stronger jobs numbers in October and bullish noises from both the Treasurer and the RBA. And in the local market, the ASX 100 fell 0.17% to 4,711, reflecting similar weaknesses from the US markets. The ASX financials were also down 0.09% to 5,635.60 in bearish territory. Regional Bank Bendigo was up 0.99% to 10.20, while Suncorp fell 0.15% to 13.54, and the Bank of Queensland was higher, up 0.82% to 9.78. Macquarie, who generates more than half of its business offshore, rose 0.16% to $119, whilst the majors were softer, with NAB down 0.46% to 23.77, Westpac down 0.28% to 25.27, and of course it went ex-div. ANZ was down 0.12% on Friday to 25.36, while CBA was up just a little at 68.90. Lenders mortgage insurer Genworth tracked lower, down 0.91% to 218, not least because they are exposed to the housing sector and the investment markets, both of which look weaker. AMP continues in weak territory, although it was up 1.98% to 258. The Australian VIX index eased back down 3.33% to 1680, still well in the nervous zone. And the Aussie Bitcoin dropped 2.76% to 7,492, and the Aussie gold slid 0.06% to 1,666.43. The property news continues south, with the latest CoreLogic average clearance rate down again last week, with only 42.7% of homes successful at auction. And that excludes the large number of unreported results, so the true numbers are even worse. There were 1,541 auctions held across the combined capital cities, having decreased from 2,928 auctions the prior week, when a higher 47% cleared. Both volumes and clearance rates continue to track lower each week, at 2,046 auctions and a clearance rate of 61.5%. In Melbourne, final results saw the clearance rate fall last week, with 45.7% of the 266 auctions successful, down from the 48.6% across the significantly higher 1,709 auctions the prior week. Across Sydney, the final auction clearance rate came in at 42.6% across a slightly higher volume of auctions week on week, with 813 held, up from 798 the previous week when 45.3% cleared. Sydney's final clearance rate last week was not only the lowest seen this year, but the lowest the city has seen since December 2008. The only capital city to see more than 50% of successful auctions last week was Adelaide at 50.8%. However, this was lower than the prior week's 57.6%. And Brisbane saw the lowest clearance rate, with only 30% of homes selling. Geelong recorded the highest clearance rates of all the non-capital city regions, with 57.1% of auctions reported as successful, while the Sunshine Coast region had the highest volume of auctions at 55%. And CoreLogic are expecting more auctions today, so we will see if this eventuates. Now, I discussed the latest household data at a UBS forum on Monday with other members of the panel that included Tim Lawless from CoreLogic, Christopher Joy from Coolumbuck Capital, as well as John Mott, the head of banks at UBS, and George Theranou, their chief economist. You can watch my segment of the discussion, Some Thoughts About the Housing Market, via a scratch recording I made. Frankly, demand for property continues to weaken as supply rises and sales volumes fall. First-time buyers and investors are becoming more cautious. And John Mott has been negative on the sector for some time, and his new note proposes a worst-case scenario in which Aussie home prices crash 30%. The RBA cuts rates to zero and launches quantitative easing, and the banks are crushed by cascading bad debts, cut dividends, and class actions. Similarly, he has developed a range of different scenarios. Scenarios will sound familiar to anybody following DFA, as we've been doing this for years. It's the best way to communicate the intrinsic uncertainty in the system. He thinks that his scenario 3, housing correction, is the most likely, with a 10% drop in prices, and that the banks will be challenged in this environment. But if prices fall further, the banks get hit with class actions and bad debts, they could have to cut dividends. SQM's Louis Christopher also issued their latest boom to bust report. And guess what? He also used scenarios. SQM's base case forecast is for dwelling prices to fall between 6 and 3%, which is a continuation of the current falls of 4.5% over the past 12 months. Sydney and Melbourne will drive the falls. Other cities will record mixed results, with Hobart expected to have a third year of strong price rises of 5% to 9%. And the base case forecast assumes no changes in interest rates, a Labour win at the next election, with negative gearing repealed and CGT changes coming into effect 1 July 2020. If SQM research is correct on the Sydney and Melbourne forecasts, it will mean that by the end of 2019, the peak to trough declines will be at least in the order of 12 to 17% for these two cities. And SQM research believes that presuming the RBA does not intervene in the market, 2020 could also have record price declines due in part to the repeal of negative gearing, which is a firmly stated Labor policy objective. As such, there is a risk that the total peak to trough declines could be in the order of 20 to 30% for the two largest capital cities. The range is dependent on what, if, and how the RBA responds to the downturn, how the economy responds to the downturn, whether the bank will be required to lift rates out of cycle, and whether negative gearing and capital gains tax concessions are repealed as per Labour Party's policy. Christopher said, if the RBA does not respond and or the bank lift interest rates again in 2019, it is possible the peak to trough falls in Sydney and Melbourne could be even more than this negative range, but we do take the view that the downturn in Sydney and Melbourne will be a significant negative for the overall economy, and so the central bank will eventually respond at some point and cut interest rates. Gareth Ed, the senior economist at CBA, discussed the drivers of dwelling prices and identified four leading indicators and that capture the momentum in the property market. They are, first, the flow of credit, i.e. housing finance; second, auction clearance rates; third, foreign residential demand; and fourth, the Housing Price Expectation Index from Westpac Melbourne Institute Consumer Sentiment Survey. Presently, all of these indicators are pointing to dwelling prices continuing to deflate over the near term, looking out over the next 6 months. Indeed, credit and prices are strongly correlated, as we've discussed before. From a dwelling price perspective, the flow of credit matters more than changes in the stock. The annual change in housing finance has a close leading relationship with the annual change in dwelling prices by around 6 months. And new lending is driven by the supply and demand for credit. The latest housing finance data indicates that the flow of housing credit continues to fall and the pace of decline has accelerated. Credit to investors has been trending down for the past 1.5 years, but it's the shift downwards in lending to owner-occupiers that is behind the recent acceleration in the decline of credit. Generally, auction clearance rates are a leading indicator of prices, and auction clearance rates tend to lead prices on average by around 2 months. Auctions are more popular in Sydney and Melbourne as a means of selling a property. As such, the link between auction clearance rates and property prices is very much a Sydney and Melbourne story. And as a rough rule of thumb, the annual change in dwelling prices tends to be negative when the auction clearance rate is below 55%. And over the past 2 years, foreign investments in Australian property has waned. This is primarily due to a lift in state government stamp duties levied on foreign investors, as well as tighter capital controls out of China. There is a decent relationship between the annual change in property prices against the share of sellers going to foreign investors. Generally, foreign purchases have led prices on average by around 4 months, although that lead time has shrunk more recently. And finally, on consumer sentiment, Ed says it has proved a very useful near-term indicator of the annual change in dwelling prices. There is, of course, a self-fulfilling aspect at work. If households expect prices to weaken, then demand for credit will fall and prices will correct lower. The reverse is also true when households expect price growth to accelerate. The House Price Expectation Index is pointing to dwelling prices continuing to deflate over the near term. Now, the RBA's Deputy Governor Guy Debelle summarised the bank's assessment of the various measures put in place to address the risks around housing lending. He argued that risks were under control, although external shocks could still hit household balance sheets. Loose lending is not seen as a risk. Well, we'll see. Whilst the regulatory measures have significantly reduced the riskiness of new home lending, we have masses of loans written under weaker regulation, which are still exposed. And he also again illustrated the fall in investor borrowing, the shift away from interest-only loans, and the significant decrease in the maximum loan size, now on offer, on average down 20%, although we think for some households the fall is significantly larger. He also showed some households were now paying higher rates thanks to larger spreads above the principal and interest loan benchmark. The trend unemployment moved a little lower, according to the data from the ABS, from 5.2% to 5.1% in October 2018. This is the lowest unemployment rate since early 2012 and the 25th consecutive monthly increase in employed full-time persons, with an average increase of 20,300 employed per month. The trend underutilization rate decreased 0.1% to 13.4%, and the trend participation rate remained steady at 65.6% in October. But wages growth remained sluggish, with the seasonally adjusted wage price index up 0.6% in September quarter and 2.3% through the year. The more reliable trend was 0.5% in the September quarter. Private sector wages grew 0.55% over the quarter, whereas public sector wages grew by 0.61%. So public sector wages are growing more strongly, whilst the private sector continues to struggle. The weak wages growth will dent the budget projections and household budgets. And Western Australia recorded the lowest through the year wage growth of 1.8%, while Tasmania recorded the highest at 2.6%. So no surprise that our Household Financial Confidence Index was lower in October. The index measures households' overall comfort levels with their finances across a number of key dimensions. Recent home price trends, lower returns on deposits, and share market gyrations have all combined to take the index lower, despite strong employment trends. The wealth effect is now working in reverse, with a potential impact on future consumption. The index returned a result of 88.1, down from 88.4 last month, and this continues the decline seen since late 2016, and it's now approaching the lowest ratings from 2015. The convergence across the states continues as home prices fall in New South Wales and Victoria, and they take a toll, with the southern states showing a significant slide. Western Australia and Queensland appear to be tracking quite closely. And across the age bands, younger households are more under pressure thanks to large mortgages or renting, while those aged 50 to 60 years remain the most confident thanks to lower net borrowings and more savings and investments. For those aged 40 to 50 years, recent falls in property prices swamp any benefit from stock market performance. And those holding property for own occupation remain the most positive despite falls in paper values of their homes, but property investors are now registering significant concerns thanks to flat or falling net income from rentals, falling capital values, and concerns about the future of negative gearing and capital gains tax relief. More property investors signaled an intention to seek to sell property as the switch from interest only to principal interest loans continues, and more than 41% of mortgage applications were rejected compared with 5% last year as more rigorous underwriting standards bear down. In fact, those renting are in some cases more confident than property investors, which is a significant turnaround. The great property investor decade is passing, and you can watch our show, Household Financial Confidence is in the Gutter. The use of the Household Expenditure Measure, or HEM, may well be back in play following the latest from the Westpac ASIC case. Given that at some banks, HEM is being used for around half of applications and the Royal Commission commented specifically on the use of HEM, perhaps the law needs to be changed. The core of the argument is whether the loans were suitable or unsuitable, and it seems that this would depend on the ultimate progress of the loan subsequently. In other words, it cannot be proved to be unsuitable until it falls over. ASIC would need to prove that the loan was unsuitable. And actually, we think the law says lenders have to verify expenses, and in other cases, for example, in payday lending, specific inquiries are required as part of the assessment. But it's as clear as mud at the moment. When is unsuitable lending to be demonstrated? And this will have a significant impact on any potential class actions. And of course, next week, the Royal Commission start their next round with senior bank executives and regulators on the stand. This should at very least be entertaining, and will perhaps get to the heart of the cultural issues in banking and finance. And in this regard, you should watch our recent show with John Dalson, businessman and ex-ANZ director, who has some important things to say about what has driven the poor outcomes from the sector and what needs to change. It's a long piece, but highly relevant, thinking about banking from the inside. But for now, banks want more data on expenses, and the latest was ANZ, who outlines new tighter rules from the 20th of November, where mortgage applicants will need to prove much more evidence and history on income and expenditure. Any income from bonuses will be ignored and income shaded to 80%, and evidence of continuous employment will be needed. As well as more granularity and evidence on expenditure, they also will want more details on potential changes to personal circumstances. And finally this week, we saw the first unnatural act from the government to support the banking sector in an attempt to alleviate the home price falls and lending freeze ahead of the election next year. The proposed $2 billion funding pool is small beer in the estimated $300 billion SME lending sector, and there is a precedent a decade ago when the government's $15 billion co-investment with the private sector into the residential mortgage-backed securities market during the GFC was put into play. So the federal government announced a new $2 billion Australian Business Securitisation Fund to help provide additional funding to small business lenders. But this is lipstick on a pig, in my view, and does not get to the heart of the matter at all. But I expect much more such measures in the run-up to the next election. And if you want to understand what is ahead, then watch my recent interview with Harry Dent as we discuss the limitations of central banks and how QE has really created a monster that is still running rampant. And we also extended our reach into the New Zealand market with the help of Joe Wilkes. See our latest Ireland v New Zealand, a passion for rugby and property. But to sum up the state of play, the Bears are indeed in town, and we should prepare ourselves for more falls ahead. Our scenarios continue to play out as expected. Finally, a quick reminder, our next live Q&A session is now scheduled for November the 20th at 8 p.m. Sydney time. You can schedule a reminder by using the YouTube link and join in the live discussion or send in questions beforehand. If previous sessions are any guide, it should be a lively event. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. And as always, if you like what you've seen here today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. I read them all. And if you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now by hitting the subscribe bell. And if you've already subscribed, many thanks. I really appreciate your support and participation. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.